I'm Dr. David Malbranche, Senior Director of Global HIV Medical Affairs at Gilead Sciences.
I am Dr. Christopher Chauncey Watson, Global Marketing Director at Gilead Sciences.
Welcome to Zero Hour, a podcast brought to you by Gilead Sciences, where we will be speaking with leading health and culture experts to understand the barriers that keep global populations from meaningful, transformative care. We'll shed light on inequities, we'll celebrate innovation, and together, we'll imagine a world with zero barriers, zero disparities, zero new infections, and zero people left behind. It's possible, but there's zero time to wait. It's time we had the talk. And we mean the talk with a capital T. The one about the birds, the bees, and HIV. That's right, we're talking about sex. And when we talk about sex, we should be talking about HIV too. Here's the thing. People living with HIV have sex. And they should have sex. But we can't keep treating HIV like a scarlet letter. And we definitely can't meet conversations about sex with burning torches and pitchforks. In today's episode, we'll chat with three very different people, a sexologist, a filmmaker, and a psychologist who have all come to the same conclusion. No matter who is having it, sex for everyone should be pure, not Puritan. Welcome to another episode of Zero Hour, a global podcast brought to you by Gilead Sciences. I'm David Malbranche.
And I'm Christopher Chauncey Watson. This podcast is intended to provide a space for open conversation about global perspectives as it relates to HIV, health, and health equity. Today, we're going to focus on how sex and HIV can coexist without shame. Our three guests are never afraid to put sex and HIV in the same sentence. Our first guest is Nathan Hale Williams. He's an award-winning writer, director of 90 Days, best-selling author, activist, and CEO of Inhale Entertainment.
Our second guest is Dr. Cedric Pulliam. Dr. Pulliam is a board-certified health psychologist and director of global public policy at the Prevention Access Campaign. Our third guest is Goody Howard. Goody is a world-renowned sexologist, educator, and consultant who has dedicated her life to empowering through sexual exploration, education, and awareness. Let's start with you, Nathan.
Well, you know, Dr. David, I have been doing this work for, a better part of 20 years. But the specific thing about 90 Days, I had a friend, we shared the same name. And then when I had moved to Los Angeles, unfortunately, that friend took their life because of their diagnosis. And they felt that because of the diagnosis, they were unable to access love and that they'd never be loved in the way that they intended to be loved. And that just hurt me. It hurt me to my core. I could not understand why a virus would make someone believe that they were unlovable. I believe that there is no such thing as a thing that makes you unlovable. And so I did what I do best, and I channeled my confusion, my hurt, and my grief into art. I had been doing some work with the CDC, and I wrote 90 Days in 6 hours on a Sunday after a milestone birthday. I channeled all of that pain and frustration and confusion. And it was my love letter to people like my friend, people living with the virus, saying that love was not only accessible, but it was something that could be a hard, fast goal.
You say that your friends, and this was your love letter to your friends, who are you speaking to in your advocacy and your art?
So, in general, Black and brown people are my people. And I believe that the models of the people that I look up to, you start at home first and then you work your way out. You know, you look at someone like a Gina Prince Bythewood, who is I have two favorite directors, Steven Spielberg and Gina Prince Bythewood. And she started with love and basketball. She started with her community. And for a long, long time, only Black and brown people knew who she was. Now, with the Woman King, she's global. And so I believe in that. I believe in starting at home with your community, talking to my community, and then the art is art and film and television should be universal. That's a whole nother conversation about how our stories are universal. I'm directly talking to Black and Brown people, but I'm talking to anyone who wants to be entertained. I always say that my art is like a spoonful of sugar. You don't even know you're getting medicine because it helps the medicine go down. Because I'm Black, you know, and I care about us. And if no one else is going to care about Black and Brown people, Nathan Hale Williams is going to care about Black and Brown people because I'm going to take care of home first.
Period.
Period.
You know, it reminds me of these moments. Sweep around your own front door first, right?
Amen.
There you go. Has an audience member ever shared with you the impact your film has made on their lives?
I mean, this film has been around the world. You know, we, you know, won at Cannes. We've been to Amsterdam. We won an African Oscar. So we've literally been around the world. So there have been many, many people that have shared the impact of it. But I if you don't mind, can I highlight two? I made this film about the Black heterosexual experience versus a homosexual or gay or queer experience because I wanted to be in places to have this conversation where we were not having it. And one of those places is the Black church. And so the very first church we ever showed 90 Days at, the first lady of the church came up to me. I'm going to say her age was about 40, but she was a Black woman. She could have been 90. You know, we don't crack. But I say her age because of the statement that she made. And she said, after watching the film, it was the first time that HIV had been humanized for her. So in her 40 years and the 30 years that the virus has been around, it had never been a human thing to her. And as shocking as that is, it was also the mission. It was also the story. The second thing is more of a group thing. A young lady, Jasmine Cinnamons, I met her in Miami. She was getting her doctorate at the University of Miami. She ended up doing her dissertation on the effectiveness of 90 days with women living with HIV towards disclosure. So, I mean, you can't get more validation than having somebody do their doggone dissertation on your film. And she is now Dr. Jasmine Simmons.
So exactly.
It must have worked. I think that's a multi-layered answer, right? You know, I think that when you're talking about HIV disclosure around people living with the virus, it's complicated. And I learned how complicated it was with touring this film. I knew it was complicated going into it, but when I started hearing stories, particularly from women, about the violence that so many women have encountered in disclosure settings. And then also that stigma, you know, the fear that you're going to be judged. You know, it's still prevalent and growing in our culture. You know, recent hip hop artists have made statements that, you know, we shot them down for. You have to have a nuanced conversation around disclosure. I think in general, American society is the most hypocritical, puritanical society on the globe, right? Because we're all doing all these things, but we don't talk about sex openly. We don't talk about our bodies. And so if we're not even talking about sex, how can you even get to HIV and disclosure? Because you don't even want to believe that people are still having sex. But like, how did we get here?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think one of the things people think is that you can just leapfrog over sex and talk about HIV. You have to talk about sex. I want to bring Dr. Pulliam into the conversation. It's great to have you here today, so thank you for coming. What would you say is the single most important goal in the work you do?
Thank you so much for having me. I think the most important part of my work is ensuring people living with HIV receive the messaging that they should receive by their medical providers. This also taps right into training, delivering key messages to the providers so that people living with HIV can have a better quality of life, but also feel just like everyone else. Mm-hmm. And that's really the essential part of my job.
You said messaging, and when I think of messaging, I automatically think of undetectable equals untransmittable, or you equals you.
Absolutely. Let's break it down.
According to multiple global health organizations, including the World Health Organization and the Department of Health and Human Services, you equals you refers to the concept that taking HIV medications as prescribed and getting to and staying undetectable for at least 6 months prevents transmission of HIV to partners through sex. Undetectable means that the virus cannot be measured by a viral load test, which is a viral load less than 200 copies per milliliter.
And that particular piece is the epicenter of sexual health and health equity, because undetectable equals untransmittable gives people hope. It gives them that freedom that, oh, I can have sex and it could be pleasurable to me. It's not something that I have to fear, or I have to fear that I potentially may give my partner HIV, that they don't have to teeter around having the conversations about their status. It reduces stigma and discrimination. All of these are elements of health equity.
Yeah. And you speak in this policy realm, so I want to keep us here a little bit, particularly in this global perspective. And how are global governments targeting sexual minorities in this?
It's very layered. The first layer, I would say, in my travels, going to the different countries, a lot of times I've seen directly where governments are utilizing dating apps and any kind of digital platforms where LGBTQ plus individuals are seeking sexual or seeking dates and having sex or meeting up with people to have sex. That's the first thing. The second thing that I really think is scary is that, you know, there's many elements of tourism and people coming in and out of different countries that do identify within the LGBTQ plus communities. And that unknown knowledge and fear of the laws that exist in these countries, the homophobic or transphobic laws that exist, the fact that sometimes they're targeting you at hotels or sites or restaurants and malls, like who you are with is important in certain countries. That's the second key that's really, really important when you think of sexual and gender minorities and how government is tracking.
And you know what? That actually brought me to an idea. When you said, when we talk about sexual and gender minorities, sometimes we talk about men who have sex with men or queer folks or transgender, non-binary. We always use those terms. But something that came to my mind was sex workers. And I thought about that part of it because that's a conversation we don't always have. And you say tourists coming into different countries. And a lot of these countries that may not have the means that are under-resourced for the HIV prevention education messaging and treatment messaging are also places that are big with sexual worker tourism. Can you speak about that a little bit?
Absolutely. Sex work is work. That's the first thing I'm going to start with.
I say that.
And a lot of governments don't recognize that. Many governments around the world. So the fact of the matter is the tourists that are coming into these countries, a lot of times on business, right? They're working. They're partaking in sex work. They're hiring men, women, whomever, trans, whomever, for a week, a day, you name it. The main thing that really doesn't get discussed a lot is how are sex workers being treated in these capacities? They're not being allowed to document this as work. That's one inequity that exists. They're not able to sometimes speak freely about what they do. When they're trying to seek health care, that health equity piece coming in, a lot of times when they're filling out a form, they don't know which one to select because right. they're fearful of the stigma,
right.
the discrimination. Am I going to even get care today because I checked this box? That's the issue sex workers see.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And I want to transition because we've been ignoring our queen. At the table. Hey, Goody.
Hi.
You've defined the relationship that the United States has with sex as puritanical.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just in regular language, it means that everyone is having sex. We're a sexualized culture, but we're not a sexually educated culture. It's the hypocrisy of it all, right? A lady in the streets and a freak in the sheets kind of thing. We are doing these things, but we're not open to have conversation. We're not open to have dialogue around sexual health. Sexual health is public health. Right. So when I say puritanical, I mean the ambient Christianity of the United States. So it's certain pieces of that, but the pieces that are oppressive or repressive are the main ones I'm speaking to.
Indeed. So given that context, how can we better educate We talked about heterosexual women mm-hmm. sometimes being ignored in these HIV prevention and sexual health conversations. Mm-hmm. How can we better educate women and empower them both with regards to sexual health and how that intersects with pleasure and HIV prevention?
I think the main thing with I don't even say heterosexual women, women that have sex with men, because you can be a lesbian and still have, you know, sex with a man occasionally, right? The messaging and the media needs to point to us. The media needs to show us, highlight us, including a lot of times there's still this stigma of, oh, people think HIV is a MSM concern. It's not our business.
Define MSM for me.
I'm sorry, men that have sex with men.
There we go.
Okay. Right? It's a queer disease. It's a gay disease. It doesn't have anything to do with me because I like men. And that's, we're doing a disservice.
Right.
So we can't even see ourselves in the media. So we can't see ourselves in the prep. We can't see ourselves in the protection. We can't see ourselves in the testing. We don't see our partners represented either. So if I don't see my partner there and I don't see me there, this ain't for me. And I think we're doing a disservice in that regard, yeah.
And you speak of disservice and you've also talked about pleasure. Mm-hmm. How does pleasure even fit into this conversation?
I think we don't even have enough conversations about pleasure in general, let alone in the HIV context. Mm-hmm. The global conversation around pleasure is penis-shaped. So women don't even, people with vulvas are not even engaged in that. Usually, all over the world, we're socialized that sex is for our partners. We're not centering our pleasure in that. When you center your pleasure as a person performing sexual acts, your health comes into play as well. So your pleasure can tell you things about your health. If sex is painful, maybe there's something that needs to be addressed there. If you're, you know, erection quality, clitoral or penile erection quality is different. That tells you something about your health. Your ability to get aroused can speak to your general health. And so when we disconnect pleasure from health, we disconnect sex from pleasure, people get lost in the sauce. And they don't know where to start, where to go, where to look. And if I'm having challenges with my pleasure, I can't talk to my doctor about that. I don't know what that even looks like. And if my doctor say, well, oh, have you been tested for HIV? Because we have to ask to be tested for HIV. They're not just going to do it unless you're pregnant, right? So not only are we not being tested unless we ask, and if we don't see ourselves in the media, we're not going to ask because our idea that we are even a person that can acquire HIV is not even on our radar.
And what role does heterosexual men play into this conversation?
I really feel like men that have sex with women get lost in the sauce too. Men that have sex with women, and I say it that way on purpose, because just because you have sex with if you have sex with men and you have sex with women, it doesn't matter. If you have sex with women one day a month, it's sex and it's with a woman, right? So men that have sex with women get lost because, again, the media around acquisition, transmission, PrEP, PEP, all of it, it looks like it's a queer disease. It looks like it's MSM, men that have sex with men. So if we don't see men that have sex with women in the media, then we don't think that they're about it either. And they say, oh, it's, you know, the gay men, or you got it from a man, so he must be gay, and all these things, as if being the gay is being gay is the worst thing you can be, right?
Yeah.
Come on. So I think that if we don't include heterosexual men or men that have sex with women in the media, in the messaging, like Dr. Cedric was saying, it's we get lost out of that narrative.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where the epidemiology or the statistics that we see in public health kind of drive where the messaging is. And you can understand that because you want to, when you see a fire someplace, you want to put out that fire. But when you're talking about prevention, you want messages that go out to everybody.
Even in a public health perspective, we're looking at the numbers and the data. The data is being misrepresented.
Yep. Ah,
if a trans man acquires HIV, a trans man that has not had bottom surgery, may have acquired it via a vaginal sex transmission, they list it as a heterosexual transmission.
Yep. Now, Goody, wait. You took me there. Break it down for me. A trans man.
A trans man that has not had gender-affirming surgery.
Pause. What does that mean?
A man with a vagina.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a thing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It is.
So a man with a vagina acquires HIV, could have possibly acquired it through vaginal sex. Right? A gay trans man.
Ah.
Oh.
Oh.
A gay trans man having sex with a cisgender man, they can acquire via vaginal sex or anal sex, but it's listed as a heterosexual transmission because the person, one of those people, has a vulva.
Yep.
And therefore, the data is incorrect, and that data leads the media.
Yeah.
And that makes the media incorrect.
Ah, and that's the problem of it, too, is that a lot of the messaging And recently the CDC had updated their pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP recommendations mm-hmm. instead of categories like men who have sex with men, heterosexual women, IV drug users, to instead mm-hmm. say any adolescents or adults having sex.
Correct.
And that's the best way you can do
that's it.
Because
if you have sex, it's you.
If it's sex, if you're having sex, regardless of you have a vulva, an anus, this is for you. So let's go.
Can I add something that yeah. just a real life thing? I'm getting ready to do a new movie called Love Will Save the Day, tackling the same things that 90 Days did. And I have two female producers that are on board. And both of them said one of the reasons why they were attracted to the project is because in their 30-something odd years of living, none of their doctors ever asked them if they wanted to take an HIV mm-hmm. test. And, you know, it's when you live in a bubble, and I live in basically a gay queer bubble, I never even thought that they're not being asked.
Nope. If they're not pregnant. So if you're pregnant, they won't even ask you. They'll just do it.
Right.
But if you're not pregnant, you have to ask for an HIV test. And even with an STI test, they're not testing, you know, the throat and the anus. They're just testing the genitals.
Yeah.
So it's just like you have to request your health care.
And yep. and what happens a lot of times in the medical conversations is that it'll be labeled as the patient or the individual mm-hmm. doesn't see themselves at risk, mm-hmm. quote unquote.
That R word, yes.
And so that's the word that they use. But the problem really is that the medical community, we don't actually reach out as much mm-hmm. and ask the questions as much. But that's a harder thing to do, to look at ourselves mm-hmm. And ask that question and really critique ourselves on whether what we could be doing better to bring
the
more people
bias.
Into the fold, the implicit bias yeah. that always happens. Let's bring Dr. Pulliam back into the conversation. How well do you think that popular media do in terms of helping people understand what healthy sex looks and feels like?
The context of the location or geographic location is very important, because the censorship of not wanting to be too provocative. A lot of those things are, you know, they have meters that they judge anything that's coming through around anything sexualized.
Right.
And I think that's a disservice. We're censoring things that, since we're not going to bring it to them, they're going to find out on their own
yep.
without any tools.
Cedric, to this point, when you look at sexual health campaigns globally, yes. do you think they're censored?
I do.
Ah.
Some of them are. Some of them do not showcase like a man and a woman or a trans person, you know, just freely, pleasurably having, you know, relations with a partner.
Talk to me about how have sexual health campaigns, what do they look like around the globe?
That's a wonderful question. Some of the campaigns have been so pleasure-filled, real, and just organic. Literally, in Vietnam, when they were rolling out their U equals U countrywide campaign, the ads included a man and a woman, or two men, a trans woman, literally with their partner laying in bed. That, you know, you could tell that they were actually enjoying pleasure versus just words and versus just graphics. It's people. It literally resonates with the person when they see that. And they're like, I'm interested in that. This is cool. I want to learn more. I've seen ads in other countries also showcase people going and getting a viral load test result. Commercials showcasing the excitement of being undetectable. That's the critical campaign graphics, videos, and messaging you want to use. Be meaningful and connect to the people. That's the most important way to actually make change.
Nathan, same question. How do you feel the popular media is doing with this?
Well, you know, I'm piggybacking on what Goody said. You know, everything from mainstream television and film to pornography is told from a penis perspective, right? It's told from a heterosexual male's desires, fantasies. And then everybody else, you're kind of like, if you fit in, you can get in. And then now we have social media and, you know, certain sites that you can create your own content and post on. And so you're also bombarded with sex, right? You know, if you scroll Instagram or any of those places, it's overly sexualized, but no one's having a conversation about it. You know what I mean? It's like, it's everywhere, but no one's having these kinds of conversations about sex and about pleasure. You know, I think today is the first time I heard about centering pleasure around yourself, right? When is the last time I thought about sex for my pleasure other than when it's solo, you know? Yeah. So, like, we're not even having these conversations. We're overly sexualized in the media, I think, in just the onslaught of it, but we're not having real conversations.
Tell me, has anyone been impacted by the work that you've done or your films?
Yeah, so, you know, I knew going into this that there was a knowledge gap, right? Just from my own, you know, kind of experiential knowledge. I didn't know how big the knowledge gap was. I was in Martha's Vineyard at the Martha's Vineyard African American Film Festival. And there's an assumption of socioeconomic status in Martha's Vineyard. And I was on stage doing a talk back after the screening. And a woman, just a little background on the film, the lead played by Tiana Paris, is the one who is HIV positive, and she's dating Taylor. And so this woman asked, was he upset that she kissed him without disclosing her HIV status? So the audience had a collective gasp, and I said to the woman, I said, you know, ma'am, you cannot contract HIV through saliva. Now, mind you, this is not 1980, 1990. This was like 2017, 2018. And then if you cross the country, and it's not an anomaly, because if you cross the country at a Black Women's Expo in Long Beach, I repeatedly got questions about toilet seats and the sharing of glasses. And this happened everywhere we went with the film. And so if you're still having to have a conversation about saliva and shared glasses and toilet seats, how do you even get to stigma or you equals you or sexual health or being sex positive? Because there's some fundamental lacking of knowledge in our community that I was unaware of that we need to address.
It just reminds me, I remember having, when I first started doing this work and at this company, and we were doing a patient conversation in Richmond, and one of the patients had shared with me that their family made them eat off paper plates. And it stuck with me so heavily. And even when I would do my patient programs, I refused to have paper plates available because it was that moment for me that we, to your point, everyone should have a right to be who they are. And it's a paper plate. How dare you, right? So,
and just, that's how dehumanizing it is that your family changes out their plates because you are living with HIV and you come over. So how do you even mentally wrap your head around acceptance and self-love when you can't even eat off of shared plates?
And that's true for, too, like the families of the people living with HIV. A lot of times they do things like that completely unaware of how traumatic and how impactful it is for the person that they love, that they care about. They don't realize that they're causing harm.
With the media, you've talked about this, but has it changed? And I want to tap into your public health here.
The first time I ever saw a condom in a sex scene was on Love and Basketball. And it was part of the sex they were having. It wasn't a conversation. They didn't stop. I'm like, oh my God, I brought a condom. I think media, it's hit or miss. So with gender and sexuality expansive sex scenes or queer sex scenes, there are some shows that get it right. Like P-Valley gets it right. But again, making condoms a part of the sex you're having, putting a condom on with your mouth or something like that, those are things that the media does not do. And to your point of social media and like these kinds of conversations, my colleagues and I cannot run ads on social media. My colleagues and I cannot go live at certain points. When Roe v. Wade got overturned, I could not go live for 3 days. I was banned from going live. So it's very strategic because we have to be as accessible as porn. Sexuality education has to be as accessible as porn, and it is not. Mm. And because we hear sex and get lost in the education piece, we get hung up on the sexual piece, they're not spaces for us to be able to have these conversations freely. I want to say, too, I get inboxes all the time with women saying that they have never had an orgasm or is something wrong with them because media tells us you're going to go into a room, it's going to be hot and heavy, you're going to have sex, you're going to orgasm at the same time and just collapse on the bed. And so there are so many women that feel like they're broken or there's something wrong with them because they haven't reached orgasm from insertive sex.
That happens with men, too.
Yes.
Everybody's kind of jaded by porn, to be honest, to think that all this happens at the same time, people have an orgasm, everybody comes at the same time, and then you fall on the bed. And the reality is, in a lot of sexual escapades, It may just be about the intimacy. Maybe one partner ejaculates quickly, has that orgasm quickly. The other partner doesn't, or the other partner doesn't feel like it.
But your orgasm, your pleasure is your responsibility.
Yes.
So you have to understand your pleasure scripts and what it looks like to you so that you can communicate that to your partner. And part of that is understanding your sexual health, maintaining your health status, whatever that is, so that you don't have that in the back of your brain so you can fully connect to your pleasure when it's time to have sex.
Listen,
you have revolutionized my life.
This is the revolutionary.
To start with understanding what makes you feel good. That sounds like what you're saying.
You have to understand your pleasure script. If you don't know, how can you tell somebody else?
Exactly.
Script myself. I do want to ask, and I'm going to come to you, Cedric, to give Goody a little bit of a moment to think so she's an advantage here. Finish this statement for me. I will end the epidemic by
ensuring that access, equity, inclusion is a reality for all people, regardless of their HIV status, and specifically, though, those living with HIV.
Come on. I will end the epidemic by
creating art and content that empowers, educates, and inspires people to take care of themselves and to know what's really out there and to take ownership over their sexual health and their lives and knowing more about HIV.
Come on, arts. Queen Goody, I will end the epidemic by.
I will end the epidemic by helping people understand expand their understanding of human sexuality and connecting to pleasure with confidence, which includes PrEP, condoms, and U equals U.
Goody, when we talk about just pleasure and sex, what does that look like? How has it changed? Is it generational?
Oh, it's definitely generational. I get booked for Sex Week a lot, so I'm on college campuses often. And these kids, you know, the administration will book me and say, we want to, you know, healthy sex 101, talk about condoms, talk about the different kinds of sex and blah, blah, blah. And I get in and I do my little spiel with my slides. And then, of course, I open it up for Q&A because that's how you really get to the meat and potatoes, right? These kids are asking questions like, how do I train my sub to do da-da-da-da? What? When it comes to spit play, what is the viral load and blah? And I'm just like, wait a minute. They wanted me to tell y'all about condoms. Y'all talking about snowballs and, you know, polyamory. And so the kids will be okay. The children are learning and researching. And I think that they're taking their sexual health seriously. They're in it for real.
There you go. And it says the children will lead us.
The children will, honey. Okay. If they talking about their subs and their polys and, you know, their polycules and whatnot, asking me questions about spit play and viral load.
I need to take a class.
All of the things.
They going in.
Things. How can I protect my dorm room if I'm into golden showers? And so those are the kinds of questions that the kids are asking. But the administration wants me to talk about, you know, types of sex. What is manual sex?
The administration is of age where that was still closing the door. It has to happen at night.
Oh, and, yes,
you know,
very much
children
that.
Needs to be in the bed.
And I say, well, we can just do ask a sexologist where they can ask anonymous questions and then like ahead of time and I can come in and answer them so that we have a student-led conversation because the administration is out of touch with the kind of sexual pleasure, sexual health priorities, and just sex in general that these kids are having. People think what I do is like just orgasms and rainbows, right? But it is applied linguistics. It is critical race theory. It is public health. It is social work. It is harm reduction. It is trauma-informed. People don't get the fact that there are so many layers to having discussions around sexual health and pleasure. It's not just sexual health and pleasure. It's life.
Yep.
If you're living, your sexual health and pleasure is a thing. So it's life.
Well, you're living because two people had sex.
Had some sex.
Yeah.
Period.
Okay.
I don't even say this wraps up this episode. This is just a pause.
Yeah.
It's just a pause. I want to thank you all, Nathan Hill-Williams, Cedric Pulliam, and Goody Howard, for joining us today and really understanding what healthy sex and a healthy conversation around sex and HIV prevention can be. We hope that you've enjoyed listening and learned something new about why, when we talk about HIV and health, sex needs to be a part of that conversation.
100% right, Chauncey. And for those of you listening in, if you liked what you heard today, don't forget to subscribe to Zero Hour wherever you get your podcasts and look for it on YouTube. For more information, please also visit GileadHIVTogether.com.
This presentation is protected by U.S. and international copyright laws and owned by Gilead Sciences. The podcast should not be copied, reproduced, or distributed in whole or in part without express permission from Gilead Sciences. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gilead Sciences.